So thank you for being here, and thank you also to the organizers and to the KIPP for the chance to be here. The second part, the Distant Giant Planets part I'm going to talk about, is literally stuff that I started working on within a couple days of getting here. So this is really a fabulous environment for, you know, sitting down and thinking all kinds of thoughts. But, well, you will tell me if they work or not. So the first part that I want to talk about, this is a little bit older, not too old, and this follows on from what Doug was talking about this morning. And so this is, again, along the lines of the sort of population synthesis. And what we have tried to do in our particular case is to incorporate interactions amongst planets, multi-planet systems, and to see what that does. And so the collaborators on this, Soko Matsumura, Fred Razio, and sort of Chatterjee from Northwestern, especially on the first part, and these are the students that I've been primarily working with on the latter things. This is my master's student, right, Guelph right now, John Russell, and Natasha Holmes, Ryan Massey were my summer students the past summer. Natasha is actually now working with Brett Gladman at UBC, and Mark Van Acker is my project student right now, so he's talking to him via Skype back in Guelph these days. Okay, so you heard all about all of this stuff, well, a lot of this stuff, this part really, this morning. So the idea is you want to simulate a whole planetary system. How do you do that? Well, there are different approaches that you can take. Of course, what we'd love to be able to do is to do a hydrodynamic simulation of the whole thing, just beginning to end. And lots of people have done this, and of course, all, you know, all these important insights that we have come from these. The big problem, of course, is they're computationally horribly expensive, and you're only ever able to take relatively short snapshots of the whole process. From the n-body side of things, what people tend to do is they tend to have these much faster n-body simulations, and then, you know, to put the disk in sort of a simple way, put some additional forces in that mimic the damping and migration effect of the disk. Lots of people have done that, and myself included. Now, if you really want to do this sort of hardcore population synthesis stuff, you have to do what Doug was talking about this morning. You have to have even faster simulations. You need to sort of Monte Carlo approaches, which have told us, of course, very important things. But the thing you do lose is interactions amongst the planets. And these are isolated planets moving in a disk. Except, as Doug has described, there are ways to sort of put that partially back in. Now, the approach that we took was intermediate between the full hydron and the n-body, which is to, and I'm going to go over this very quickly because I don't think I have time to go into the code too much, but the basic idea is we took an existing n-body code. This is the Duncan Levison Lee Simba code, and added to this a simple, and very simple, and one-dimensional disk. And so the disk evolves by an alpha viscosity. Now, of course, the disk is no good unless it actually couples to the planets. We do this by putting in, early on for type 1, we put in the prescription for type 1. Later on, when these planets become bigger, we actually explicitly calculate the planet disk torques between planet and disk using this Goldreich and Tremaine torque density prescription. Another very important part is to get the gas accretion of the disk onto the planet. And so we use early on fits to the Pollock et al. Core accretion model. And at later times, we use fits to the 2D hydro simulations from Tanigawa and Watanabe. But as we heard this morning from Ichiro, there are some modifications that probably have to be done to this when you're looking at things in 3D, so we're very interested to look at this more closely. What do 3D effects do, especially later on? Anyway, so the upshot of all of this is that we have a code that reproduces reasonably well all the key features of the planet formation process, migration, eccentricity, damping, gap opening, but we can run the entire life of a typical disk in a week or two.
So when you say eccentricity damping, you're using the the standard, the Gorsh and Tremaine formula for the damping?
Well, we do. We basically use the type 1 regime. We just use the type 1 damping prescription from Tanaka et al., essentially. And then once we start opening a gap, I mean, it gets a bit tricky. What do you do? So we do kind of a little bit of a hand-wavy thing. We basically look at the gas that is near the location. We average, essentially, the gas between Perry and Applehoof, where the planet is at the moment in its gap. And so if there's still a bit of gap, there's a bit of gas in the gap, it still gets damped. If there isn't gas, it sort of gets damped on the same time. We try to be conservative, right, because we're interested in how do you get big eccentricities, and we felt with air on the side of more damping rather than less. But what does happen is as you overrun, if you become eccentric, as you overrun the gap and you start getting into the disk again, then you start getting damped more strongly. So it's kind of a bit of a rough and ready way to do it, but we think that it does a reasonable job, given what we know.
But do you consider issues like the saturation of corrosion?
Yeah, so I think there are fundamental issues there. That
sure. Sokol is actually looking at that right now. There was a paper that was, I think it's an AstroPH. It was just accepted. So she has tinkered with the code a bit more to explicitly put in that. And I mean, basically, it doesn't make, we don't think it makes a large difference, but it does make some difference.
But do you allow for eccentricity excitation?
No. Now again, the idea is that we want to be conservative. We want to err on the side of lower eccentricities rather than higher eccentricities. You know, because one of the things we want to get out of this is some robust mechanism of how can you believe we make big eccentricities. So we don't let the disk just by itself pump up the eccentricities and go in circles.
Oh, that's what you mean by conservative.
Yeah. So, you know, since I'm going to be showing a number of these little movies of this, I should just, it's fairly self-explanatory, but I should go through quickly what is actually going to be shown. So we have these little, this is one example frame here. So we have surface density of the disk on the left and grams per square centimeter. This is the disk here. And you'll have, you see the planets in the disk. The white part is the core. The blue part is the gas envelope, and the masses are in Earth masses. The right scale is the eccentricity, so higher up planets are more eccentric, and we have a little error bar sticking out of the planet, these things that where you can read off the inclination. So the disk, again, the disk is 1D, so the code is 3D. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not good. Okay, so I guess I haven't been recorded until now. Okay, well, that's okay. The part up till now was not that interesting. now we get to the pretty pictures. Okay, so
and the sizes of the circles are the same representation, sort of?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
And what does it mean if they're up or down, if they're planets and you got a vertical scale that is density?
This scale applies to the disk, and these two scales apply to the planets. It's a bit busy, I realize. Time is up there, and I think that's about it. So,
that is when you're in.
Yeah. And yes, that's right. That's right. Red is one. You have to make compromises somewhere. One limitation here is that we have to have an inner edge to these simulations. Otherwise, the time step becomes horribly slow, and they become horribly slow. So if things drop below some Perry, and I think it's 0.05 AU in this case, they're just removed from the simulation. This is the image of the last place where they were. So just to show an example, so this is an example here. You see the cores, initially 10 to the minus 3 Earth masses, they start growing. I slowed things down because this is where the interesting stuff happens. You see envelopes start to grow. This is the first gas giant here, and you see a lot of scattering happening when the first gas giant grows. This is the second one. One's lost. This one's parked at the inner edge of the disk. Three more grow here. Things start to slow down because you see the disk has evolved, so now we're in sort of a more planet-dominated rather than disk-dominated regime. You can see large eccentricities happening, we lost another one. And you also see an inner hole that's formed here. Basically, the planets are holding up the outer disk, and now things speed up because, the disk goes away.
and this at this point is just pure n-body. So this is an example of one of these simulations.
So why is it that the inner is not at a fairly substantial distance?
Well, I mean, there are two sort of extremes of how you can lose them at the inner edge. You can actually have them move all the way in, or you can have them become eccentric enough that their parity crosses the inner edge.
And then that's when you stop.
In any case, if any part of the planet crosses the inner edge of the boundary, it's yanked out.
That's what just happened. That one was not very very eccentric, and it got kicked.
Let's see. Oh, maybe I should do that here. Actually, I think I'm able to control this one here. Or not. I guess when you have the presenter view, your little controls go away.
What holds this beyond 0.02 of AU?
Just the boundary condition. Just set it's a zero torque boundary condition. So we just impose a cavity.
Why it's
it's relatively large. Again, this is a computational compromise because what we wanted to do. I mean, you could only go into 0.05 AU for the whole simulation, and what we did want to have the disk that actually stopped a bit further out than that. So we wanted the disk not to necessarily go all the way into the inner edge of the simulation. So we made an artificially large cavity on the inside.
So also. There's one planet there that has very small atmosphere.
This one, yeah.
Yeah. So why isn't it able to accrete?
Just a matter of timing. You'll see more of those later on. Simply a planet that got massive too late in the game, so there's not much of a disk left. So it's sort of an analog to our Uranus and Neptune.
Is the system stable?
Well, it went to 100 million years. So on that time scale, it's stable. On a longer time scale, I don't know. These two are in a resonance, actually, so that's helping there. So even though their eccentricities are fairly high, they should be, they're fairly deep in the resonance. This one I'm not so sure about. And let's see, so now, again, Doug has gone over all of this, and we can understand why there's a particular location in the disk where these things first grow, where we first get cores that are the right size, and Ichiro and Shigeru have done a lot of work on this. Also, and furthermore, we can also understand why there is, when there's the first gas giant that appears, and you get this sort of burst of rapid formation that spreads out from one location. And that's kind of turns out to be kind of a generic feature of these simulations. And it's when that burst first appears, when in the lifetime of the disk that happens, that seems to be, we find, is very important determining what the system ends up looking like in the end. And anyway, so this is all the results really in a nutshell. So we did a bunch of these simulations. This is a grid of 100 here, covering what's sort of the parameter space, the relatively believable part of the parameter space of the initial disks in two of the important parameters, which is disk mass, so from 0.01 to 0.1 solar masses, and disk viscosity, which we parameterized in the usual alpha manner, so from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2. And so each of these little things, and I realize they're a bit hard to make out, but you kind of get an idea. Each one of these is just a snapshot of the system at the end, which in most cases is 100 million years, long after the disk is gone. And you see things are quite stochastic, certainly, but you do notice that there are, right away, that there are some trends. There's this whole area down here where you make no gas giants at all. There's this area here where you tend to make multiple gas giants, and you see lots of signs of migration. A lot of these have actually been dumped off the inner edge of it and used a slightly different edge here. And we can understand that, of course, in terms simply of these two timescales, the timescale of the disk lifetime and the timescale for that burst of that first gas giant to appear, that burst of gas giant formation to start. And, you know, deep into this region, of course, you form lots of gas giants, and in the disk lifetime you form them early and often. There's lots of opportunity for interaction. Actually, I should probably go the other way around because I have actual examples here. So if we take, actually, we'll start on the boring side. We'll start on the no planets part of the parameter space. So if you look at an example here, the same sort of animation that I just showed you before, things start to grow, cores start to grow down here. They start to accrete some tenuous atmospheres, but you can see that this wasn't very big to begin with, and it's already dropped quite a ways. So as the disk depletes, you know, it's too fast, and the planets grow too slow. So you end up with nothing more in the end than some shrunken Neptunes, essentially. Now, if you look up here into the region where you do falling gas giants, you get what's basically just like that first example, or similar to that first example I showed you. Again, the beginning plays out pretty similarly. The cores start to grow, start to migrate. The first few gas giants form. In this case, they get quite eccentric. There's knocking each other around. We actually lose, I think, all except one of them in the end. So, in the end game, because we have to artificially remove these things of small period, we're not fully representing what happens in the end game, but what we can tell you is we certainly can get very large eccentricities out of all this.
Why don't you lose all the cores? The standard argument is that at one or few AUs, tens of factors, you're going to...
Sure. Well, the thing is, the disk is evolving all the while that this is happening. You see, by the time the first gas giant forms, we're actually down to less than a tenth of a minimum mass nebula. So we like the disk to be, and I mean, this maybe goes a bit against what Doug would like, but we like the disk to be massive for the sake of giving us lots of solids. But we can deplete the gas a whole heck of a lot and still be able to grow viable gas giants. And so the point is that by the time big things start to actually form, the disk is sufficiently depleted that this migration is no longer such a big problem. And I mean, this depends, of course.
The open gas?
The early phase, yeah, type 1. I mean, type 1 goes linearly with the surface density. So if you drop the surface density by more than an order of magnitude, you drop the migration by more than an order of magnitude, so that really helps you a lot. And the other thing, of course, is, you know, the nice thing about these disks is you have a continuum of time scales, growth time scales as you go out. So, I mean, while in general you will, and Doug and Shigeru have shown this also, you will lose the inner part, the inner large cores that you make. But as you go far enough out, the growth time scale becomes long enough that you don't get big until the disk is fairly low. So, you know, it seems like fine-tuning, but it isn't actually, because you have a continuum of time scales, and eventually you hit the sweet spot no matter what.
So you don't do anything to adjust the type 1 rate?
No, we just use the Tanaka et al. Type 1 rate, and it works.
And how does a disk depletion occur? Is there a...
It's an alpha disk, so an alpha disk with, well, a very large radius, it's 500 AU or something like that. We have an open boundary, and on the inside we have an open boundary. So it just spreads and viscously evolves. And that's...
No,
not explicitly. Effectively, what we do in somewhere deep down in the code, if the density drops to some very, very, very low value, we just set it to zero. So you can think of that as sort of an analog to photo evaporation, but not. It's probably not, you know, it's less than photo evaporation, maybe. So effectively, no. It just evolved by itself. Okie dokie. Oh, right. So now there's this region in the middle, right, where the time scales are similar. And this turns out to be quite important and quite especially interesting for us. Because if you look at the example here, so you have sort of an intermediate case, which I guess didn't quite place in here. There you go. So the same sort of beginning part of the simulation, things are growing, you see a pair of gas giants forming. The disk is fairly low by this point, but they do manage to form a pair of these guys. And if you look at this, it starts to look a little bit familiar, right? It looks like home. Because we have two gas, I mean, the masses aren't quite right, obviously, the locations, but you have two gas giants. They're at relatively low eccentricity. They grew so late in the game that they never migrated very much. And, you know, just for laughs, we've got something that looks like a Uranus and an Neptune on the outside. Again, masses aren't quite right, the gas ratios aren't quite right, but we have something that qualitatively resembles our solar system.
Except eccentricities are kind of large, right?
A little bit, yeah, but I mean, one thing that's...
Would that have much of an effect on the terrestrial planet system?
If they were that large, yes. I mean, the secular resonances that Doug was talking about would be significantly stronger. Now, one thing that is missing from all of this is planetesimals, and those would have some effect on the giant planets, but especially they would on these guys. And I mean, at some point, the gas density is going to drop lower than the planetesimal density. And then at this point, I'm going to say more about this in the instant. At this point, the damping dynamical friction from the planetesimals becomes important. That will certainly drop these eccentricities. It will probably have some effect on these also.
For this case, how high is the interstellar density compared with the atom mass?
Good question. You probably figure that out from looking at the. So it's kind of around here. So it's 0.06 solar masses.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's about. Yeah, it's sort of in the middle. Mm. Yeah, it's about five times, maybe 3 to 5 times minimum.
But would you claim that you can change alpha and get. Because you're along this.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole.
Kind of just with this mass.
Right. And so that's sort of the next thing, really. This is the claim that we make here, that it's this band here, you know, whatever you believe the actual parameter space of the initial disk is, it's this band here where the formation time scale and the depletion time scale are comparable, where you have the best shot at making the solar system analog. And now, furthermore, of course, you don't really know. We're only very weakly constrained as to what the initial disk properties actually are. They could be whatever subset of this, but because this is a relatively narrow band, and because furthermore, you know, there's a very strong stochastic component to all this, I've sort of outlined in black here the ones that are sort of plausible solar system analogs. You see, it's not everything in there. Because of that, what we claim is that solar system analogs are not the majority outcome. In fact, they're probably some smaller subset of the whole ensemble of exoplanets. So, I mean, there's certainly going to be more of them. We can understand how they come to be, but they're probably not enormously numerous.
Have you looked how sensitive that is to the other disk parameters? You have here the mass of the disk. It could as well be the surface density distribution or the size?
Sure, yeah, I mean, there are lots of other things that can vary. The opacity will change, the timing of the, you know, we haven't, it's a big parameter space, so we picked what we thought were the most important ones, or the ones, you know, the most easily graspable ones, perhaps, for us. But you're absolutely right. It's important to look, I think, at, and we will try to do this, to look at how this changes with other parameters, like disk profile, opacity, and any number of other things, of course.
In the top of your top region, there's actually a lot of them that don't have any gas giant planets.
Yes, well, actually, what I should mention, this whole set of 100 was actually done with a slightly different boundary conditions than some of the individual simulations that I showed. And what happened there is that we did, in fact, have a disk that went all the way. Well, actually, what happened is we had an inner edge to our simulations that was bigger. So they were getting eliminated before they fell off the disk. So there wasn't that possibility of parking them at small radius. If you believe that there's some inner edge, some parking mechanism to the inner edge of the disk, these red circles would still, some of them would still be there in all cases, and having undergone interactions, many of them would probably still be quite eccentric.
And one thing that I'm a little bit concerned is that you said that you just used Tanaka Ito formula for migration, right?
For things that are small, yes.
Okay, so. At, you know, a few AU or so, 10 Earth mass object, the migration time scale, according to Tanaka, is very, very short.
Yes, absolutely. In a minimum mass solar nebula, it's very, very short.
No, but even with five, well, if you have 5 times minimum mass nebula, which, you know, these sweet spots.
Initially they are, yeah.
Right.
But I mean, by the time these things get that big, the surface density has typically dropped actually below minimum mass significantly.
But it's so, still less than 10 to the 5 years, right? For 10 Earth mass object.
Yeah, well, yes and no,
so
it depends.
How do you then get the gas accretion out so fast to make them into gas giants without a stopping mechanism?
Well, I mean, it does work out. I mean, we use for the gas accretion, we use really just the Pollock et al. Model as parameterized by you guys, actually. I think it's Bryden and Lin.
It takes a long time. It takes, for 10 Earth mass object, it still takes about 1 million years.
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends on your opacity, right? We have one thing that we assume. What we assume here, and this is actually important. I should have mentioned this. We do assume an opacity that is reduced by an order of magnitude below what Pollock et al. Assumed, and I think everybody kind of does that nowadays, because otherwise that plateau of core accretion is impossibly long. It's like 8 million years or something like that. So that helps a lot. I mean, that shortens that a lot.
Even with that reduction, you still get a million years growth time. So if the migration time scale is 1/10 of that, without a stopping mechanism, how do you make it into gas giant?
Well, it's not quite that bad. I mean, it's not, I don't think I quite agree with the numbers there. I mean, it's not a million years necessarily to grow a planet. And again, I mean, the thing that I was saying before, this is a problem in the inner region. You can kind of see that here. In the inner region, you tend to lose these things. If you go far enough out, then the disk depletes even more, and then it's not a problem.
Is your caterpillar of little things interacting? It's an N-body simulation. Right?
Yeah, they're all interacting.
Does that slow things down relative to sort of a straight single body type?
That's a part of it too. I mean, the whole thing you can think of as kind of a competition between the disk and the planets. And the more of the disk you turn into planets, the more, you know, the planets, the better the planets do, right? Because there's more mass that the disk has to push along. So that is certainly a part of it, and it's certainly a part of it once you start making multiple gas giants. And what you see happening typically is you end up with this configuration of multiple gas giants that have carved themselves out a hole in the middle of the disk, on the inside of the disk. And now that's an exaggeration because of R1D disk model. So they're not going to be this clean, these holes, but there's certainly going to be a significant reduction of gas on the inside. And this is also important in allowing these eccentricities to get quite high, because if you're trying to do that out here in the disk, you'd have too much damping. So this hole in the middle is sort of like a playground for big eccentricities, you can think of it as. Okay, so I guess I should try to move on. So this is getting very close to the new stuff now. So again, the one thing that you see happening in all of these simulations is pretty ubiquitous, is when you start having this burst of gas giant formation, you get a lot of this scattering of these smaller cores, these failed cores, as Doug was talking about. And you know, in our simulations, we tend to lose them off the inner edge, again, because of the edge we have to put it, but a lot of them are getting scattered outwards too. Now this spray of scattered cores is important because, and this goes back to my stuff that I did for my PhD thesis, this is how you can solve the problem of Uranus and Neptune. I mean, Uranus and Neptune, as you know, are difficult to form in situ, 20 and 30 AU. The growth time scale for a 10 or 20 Earth mass core is really embarrassingly long. So the idea that we hit on is, you know, why don't you make them amongst Jupiter and Saturn? Jupiter and Saturn get big, they scatter them out. They get recircularized. Back then we didn't have any gas, we did it just with planetesimals, and that works fine. Probably it's a combination of the two. And so this was back in this Nature paper back from 1999. And now just as a little aside, you know, maybe you're looking at this and you're thinking, ooh, you know, compact solar system, that kind of sounds like the Nice model, doesn't it? Now if you'll notice, this is 1999, the Nice model is from 2005. So yes, indeed, the Nice model took the compact solar system idea from us and, you know, ran with it. And well, our mistake was we did this and we did not come up with a cool name. There you go. So now everybody remembers this. Everybody thinks of compact solar system. Ah, the Nice model. So this illustrates the importance of what is known in the corporate world as branding. There you go. And advertising is important. Anyway, okay, so, and the upshot of all of this, this happens all the time, so, you know, Uranus and Neptune analogs ought to be really common. You know, I said that our solar system is maybe not that common, Uranus and Neptune should be really common. Very good. But that is not all, or I guess as Steve Jobs would say, oh, and one more thing. So this brings us to the distant giant planets. Now, I guess I don't have to say too much about these. You know all about these. I mean, we have Fomalhaut B, which is a less than 3 Jupiter mass thing at 115 AU, low eccentricity. again, as I've been finding out, there's some controversy about this. But anyway, we have HR8799, which is three planets from 24 to 68 AU, 10 and 7 Jupiter masses. Eccentricities at least below 0.4, and we have, and I'm happy that Rajay pointed this out to me, we also have this system here, 330 AU, about 8 Jupiter masses. So we have these crazy systems, and I think I speak for all theorists, that this was the initial reaction, was sort of along the lines of, what the hell? but of course, being theorists, you know, theorists have no problem very quickly coming up with all kinds of ideas. How do you make something at these large radii? Well, in situ core accretion. And there's a very nice paper by Dodson Robinson et al., which Ichiro pointed me to, which goes through all of these. So with their most optimistic representation of core accretion, they still couldn't get it working beyond 35 AU. What if you form them and then you migrate them? Well, by planetesimal scattering, you can migrate smaller things, but something like a gas giant is kind of a non-starter. Type 3 migration, we know, can be very fast and can go both ways, can go outwards also, but it's really just applicable to smaller things, and in any case, it's likely, I mean, you need a steep density gradient to get this started, and you probably just move by a factor of 2 in semi-major axis. Now, there's this idea that you could have two planets sharing a gap, like a Jupiter and a Saturn, and they're sharing a common gap, and the asymmetry of the torques, if the Jupiter is on the inside, can move you outwards, which is great. This model actually to Massey and Snellgrove. Unfortunately, if you look at this more closely, it requires you to have non-accreting planets. And now we know that if you have the Saturn is going to be in a partial gap. I mean, the Saturn is not going to make a deep gap. And every simulation that I've seen of accretion rates onto planets has the peak of accretion rate around a Saturn mass. So I don't know how you would prevent a Saturn mass planet from growing, the upshot being that you would very quickly have not a Jupiter and a Saturn, but two Jupiters, or even bigger in the gap. But basically, this would only work if you could migrate on a time scale short compared to the gas accretion time, which strikes me as a little bit unlikely. Other possibility, post-formation scattering. Can you, you know, make a bunch of these things and have them rattle around? Dodson Robinson et al. Tried this out. Is unlikely to give you stable orbits. They tend to just keep going and get launched out of the system.
Ed,
yes.
So we found that's true for HR8799, but not necessarily generally true.
Okay.
So
not necessarily.
You know, Kristen and I both found that you can have stable orbits for at least on the scale of 10 to 50 million years beyond 100 AU, perhaps for different systems, just based on scattering.
Okay, yes, and I'm sorry, I forgot you are one of the authors on this, of course.
No, what you said is true, though. For this system, we found very...
Okay. And I guess what you settled on as the most likely explanation then was gravitational instability, which, as you were saying, has its whole own set of problems, but I mean, I don't know... I'm not Alan Boss, I don't know about gravitational instability, but my understanding is if it would work, you would have the best shot at it at large radii, probably. Anyway, but so here's the, here is my idea on how to do this. Very simply, you scatter these things when they're still coarse. So you do exactly this, which seems to happen by itself anyway. You scatter these little itty-bitty cores out to large radius, and after they're scattered, after they're implanted, seeded out into the far reaches of the disk, then they can accrete gas. Now, two immediate advantages here, it would seem. First of all, I mean, as you can see, they're easy to scatter. It happens. It's hard to prevent from happening. Secondly, now we know that these detailed calculations that Pollock et al. Did, that Ikoma et al. Did of core accretion, while the cores are still being bombarded by accreting planetesimals, it delays the onset of runaway gas accretion. The energy input into the atmosphere prevents the envelope from contracting, so in practice, usually the accretion has to stop before you get runaway accretion. Now, if you imagine you take one of these things and just fling it way out into the outer disk, hardly any planetesimals left, so suddenly you've taken away the accretion and the envelope is free to collapse. So that certainly seems like something that will also help.
Sorry, I'm missing something. And where in the simulations are your things at 100 AU?
They are, sadly, they are not in there. What we're hoping, you know, is a plausible claim is that these things that we have to prematurely remove might have ended up at large radius. Now I've actually...
But inside.
Yes. Yes, but I mean, we're basically, every time something gets to large eccentricity, we're removing, of course we're removing it at apo because that's where the offending, or sorry, at peri. We're removing it at peri because that's where it crosses our boundary.
Apo gets you a factor of two, that's it, because it actually doesn't do anything.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, we're not letting the eccentricity grow higher than that. I mean, there would be more evolution, more scattering beyond that.
But E equals one at one AU is still going to get you an apo of two AU, not 100 AU.
Sure, but I mean, you can see there's a whole mess of these things. The giant planets are further out. So I mean, these things bounce around a fair bit. It's like a random walk with a sticky boundary. We're yanking out everything that evolves to high eccentricity. I mean, we're not claiming that they're scattering from that exact location. They're going to go back out again.
Your first panel, there's like an Earth mass thing that shows up going out there.
Yes. And this is, my project student is working on this right now, and we sort of had to drop back down to n-body simulations where you can look at small peris, and it really does look like that makes a significant difference, and you can scatter things. I mean, you can try this out with n-body simulations. You can scatter things.
So does that raise the issue that you may want to worry about ties as well?
Well, I mean, this is all happening on real short timescales, so probably not. I mean, if you left them there, yes, absolutely. But this is all happening on, you know, way less than a million year timescale, so probably not.
And ultimately, isn't this going to run into what I guess is probably the problem just for your scattering issues, which is...
Should show the hydro simulation.
Well, the scattering is going to continue until something breaks it. Right. Mm-hmm. So going in, okay, it's the star. Going out, it's usually ejection. So you walk in the tightrope between getting them out to 100 AU, but not losing them as
yes.
cores.
Yes. Right? Which makes and I agree that that's probably, I mean, it's certainly going to be more difficult to get them out to 100 AU for formal out B than to something like HR8799. That's relatively easy to do.
But we should distinguish from those, right?
We should. I mean, sorry, I want to get on to the hydro simulation. And I agree. And this is stuff in progress. And I think you're absolutely right. The scattering part needs to be looked at more closely. But what I've done here is I've said, okay, suppose you can manage to do this. Suppose you can manage, and we have here, this is the initial condition, this is a planet. A core, 15 Earth masses, peri is at 10 AU, so we suppose it's just gotten like a big kick from something at 10 AU. Apo is somewhere out at 500 AU. And this is done now not with the hybrid code anymore, this is done with Frederic Masset's Fargo code. So this is a 2D hydro code. We have a initial, this is the initial surface density of gas. If you look at this, this is the density scale. Now, this is actually significantly depleted. This is like 1/20th of minimum mass solar nebula. So we're imagining a system where we've evolved quite far already. The disk is significantly depleted, but there's still gas there. So we have our eccentric body out here at time zero, and this is just the nice disk portrait. You know, since I'm an n-body person and I finally get to play with hydro codes, I couldn't resist putting this in too. So we'll start this going. And so this is what happens. So this thing is slowly growing at first. And I should point out, we had to modify the accretion rate of small bodies. We basically had to strap on the Pollock et al. Prescription for core accretion. Otherwise, the growth is enormously fast right from the beginning, which is not right. And so you can see this thing starts growing. And it starts damping in eccentricity as it grows. And so now it's like a Jupiter mass. Its eccentricity is quite low. You can see here, you can see the spiral starting to form, the streamer starting to form. You probably saw some sort of epicyclic motion here simply because this is an eccentric planet and this is being done in the average co-rotating frame of the planet. So as it's eccentric, you see it doing this sort of thing. And it basically just keeps growing. It sits there and keeps growing. You can see a bit of a gap starting to form. The reason the gap is not terribly deep is because what I've put in here is a slightly flared disk. This is just sort of the minimum, the standard Hayashi profile. So the disk is slightly flared, and the scale height at 100 AU is actually fairly high, so it gets harder and harder to open a gap, but it doesn't really strongly depend on that. Anyway, so there you have it in a nutshell. You take the thing, you make the core, you scatter it out, assuming you can manage to do that. You let it sit out there, and then it's free to accrete its gas envelope. And even in a fairly low-density gas disk, you can still grow to a fairly large mass.
So
So this cord that get kicked, in general, is an inclined orbit, right? But you put them under.
Well, this is in Fargo, so Fargo does everything 2D. I assume it's in the plane.
But in general, it should be out of the plane.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, that might certainly modify your accretion efficiency. Unfortunately, Fargo couldn't do that.
But you put them on a plane, on a disk plane.
Everything is, there's no inclination is identically zero, I think, for everything.
It also looks like this was on a roughly circular one, right? Because it came down more or less vertically.
No.
And is,
no.
Is the physical
quite
radius
eccentric
to the Roche radius, what ratio did you take it in your simulation?
The physical radius to the... Well, planets in Fargo don't actually have a physical radius.
Well, you remove material.
Oh, yes, good point. Yeah, so I should say a bit more about how we modified the accretion. So the accretion in the base Fargo code that you download off Frederick's website basically removes gas from the Hill or Roche. I guess it actually always takes the Hill sphere, I think. Maybe it uses the... I think it's the Hill sphere on a few orbital timescales. And if you do that, that's way, way, way too fast. So what we actually did is we, first of all, we changed it so we only remove gas from one sink cell at the location of the planet. The code removes gas from the Hill radius, from all over the Hill radius. So you, I mean, we're not claiming that we're resolving the Hill radius terribly well, but at the same time, we wanted to sort of be conservative in the sense that we want the code to actually, you know, honestly deliver the gas to the planet before we consider it accreted. So again, we're trying to be conservative on the side of low accretion.
Sink cell, how big is the sink cell compared to the semi-major axis?
Now this is a logarithmic spacing here in semi-major axis, and there's 100 rings per decade in semi-major axis. So if you work it out in terms of the scale height of the disk, I tried this with two different resolutions. I doubled the resolution and the results look quite similar. I doubled the resolution. It's the highest resolution that we used was like 16. One scale height would be 16 cells. So somewhere around there.
16 cells.
16 cells. So in other words, once your planet becomes massive enough that it's Roche lobe pokes out of the disk, then there'd be 16 cells going across its Roche lobe.
The physical radius is about 10 to the minus 5 at 100 AU.
Yes.
About 10 to the minus 5 of the semi-major axis.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I mean, we had, and the other thing that's in there is there's a sort of a scaling for, to try to make this as resolution independent as possible. We look at the gas, the sound speed in the gas compared to the distance across the cell size, so that we can't, you know, somehow make the accretion rate ridiculously big just by putting in big cells. And it's not completely resolution independent. I experimented with this. It does make, you do tend to drop the accretion rate down a little bit if you make the resolution higher, but it's not a strong dependence. So I don't think that makes a very big difference. Having said that, higher resolution is of course always better. So,
the time scale for this gas accretion,
yes,
is 5 to 10 to 5 years?
To the 5, yes. This goes for 500,000 years.
But if you, the gas accretion is in 3D,
mm-hmm,
so this time scale can be fueled as a magnitude.
Yes. Well, I looked at, after we were talking yesterday, I looked at the paper, I looked at your paper, and I looked at the accretion timescales and the Tanigawa and Watanabe, and I mean, since we're using initially at small mass, we're using just directly the Pollack et al. Results, and if you compare the results, the Pollack et al. Results are actually lower than everything. They're very, really very low at small mass. So I think at small mass, like 15 to 30 to 40 Earth masses, we're being pretty conservative about the. I mean, we're below your 3D rates. I agree, though, and this is something that I'd be very interested to look at more. I agree that once we get to larger mass, once we get into the runaway regime, I think then this will make a difference. And now I don't think it critically depends on that. I mean, you'll notice that by the time we get to the end of the simulation, there's still a fair bit of gas around. There's not much of a gap, and this thing is still happily growing. So I think you could greatly reduce the gas accretion rate in the latter parts and still get away with this. It's the stuff, and it's the beginning, I think, that's more critical, and especially also that you damp the eccentricity fast enough that your peri gets pulled away from whatever scattered you. That's also important. And I guess let's just put up the summary here. Anyway, so for the beginning part, what I was showing you really is just to show that, I mean, planetary systems, if you put in all the interactions, they really do seem to be born in this complicated interplay of planet disk interactions, planet-planet interactions. Competitive accretion actually turns out to be very important. I didn't really go into this, but this idea that once your neighbor, your outer neighbor, starts growing big, it cuts off a lot of your gas supply, that seems to be a very important factor in what the final masses turn out. Much more so in many cases than what is your gap opening mass. So the upshot of all of that is your average system really does seem to be like the average system we see out there. Hot Jupiters, resonances, dynamically crowded systems, high eccentricities. And what we're claiming is that solar system analogs require a little bit more, I don't really want to call it fine-tuning, but maybe it sort of is, of disk properties. And you have to sort of hit this area, this region of disk property parameter space where you don't grow a gas giant until there's not very much gas left. One thing that we find are common are this is this, you know, scattering out of all the failed cores. And in some cases, this will give us Uranus and Neptunes. In other cases, what I'm claiming now is that it might give you these distant giant planets. So it's kind of interesting if you think about it that way, that Uranus and Neptune, our own system might, you know, if things had been a little bit different, we might have ended up with distant giant planets instead of ice giants. Maybe one last thing to mention is, I mean, generically, any mechanism that will take cores from the inner planetary system while there's still gas present and deposit them far out is going to be able to do this. So there's a paper that was just showed up on AstroPH not too long ago, Hal Levison, me, and Martin Duncan, where we look at, we focus on planetesimal accretion to grow cores. We focus on the core growth problem and found some interesting effects, in particular, you know, some parts of the, you know, in some cases you can actually get rapid runaway outward migration by way of planetesimal scattering of the outermost cores in your population. Now, I would hesitate to claim that that would take you out to 100 AU, but it might help in delivering things a little bit further out than they would be otherwise. So. I mean, generically, anything that will take a core and drop it in the outer part of the disk while there's still gas present gives you, I think, a good chance to make a distant giant planet. And I will end there, I think. Yes?
So the picture you showed is, you know, the last half of the picture is very clean. You have this core that's dropped at large radius, mm-hmm. grows to form. Yes, right. I didn't really catch the timescales, though. Is there an issue? I mean, so the question is, will you kick out just one core and it grows that simply? Or, I mean, you have some rate at which you kick out cores, right?
Yeah.
Right, so is there an issue with there being more than one core out of large radii growing in this thing?
There could well be. I think if you have more than one core, you'll end up with something like HR8799.
Okay.
Because you have multiple. You have multiple. Maybe you don't get them quite as far out, but you have multiple planets. I haven't tried this.
So they would just grow independently? I mean, I don't have a good sense for this. I don't know how well they'll strong they
are. I mean, it would be fairly stochastic, I think, what would happen. If you deposit them close enough to each other, they might start competing for gas. Now, if they're far enough out, they're going to have a hard time, as I was showing, opening clean gaps, so the competition might not be all that much. They can certainly keep scattering each other if they encounter each other, so it becomes really quite stochastic at that point. It would probably look cool, so I think that's what I'm going to run next.
Just a small comment on the, just to connect, because of these giant planets at wide distances, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it would be cool if they can be kicked out and grow out there. Mm-hmm. But as a naive observer, I'm starting to kind of think it's actually coming, it might be more the tail of the binary star formation
rather than the high end of, even though, you know, I call the planets anyway, whatever, but I mean, we can argue about that. But there might actually be another channel for making planetary mass companions, which is the tail end of the binary formation rather than the high end of the planet growth. So the other reason, I mean, one of the reasons I'm sort of favoring that is part, well, so you can, I mean, if you look at it naively as sort of a continuum of kind of, you know, even including Alan Boss's ideas of disk fragmentation, if you can fragment a binary at the protostellar stage, at a very, very early stage when it's not even, perhaps not even a Keplerian disk, but a you know, flattened envelope or whatever. So what we've done, for example, in the case when we found this eight Jupiter mass companion, we looked at about 100 stars in Upper Scorpius, and we have two other companions as well, and actually one of them is higher mass companion, but in terms of mass ratio is even lower than this one.
I see.
So I'm kind of coming to this point from an observer point of view where maybe a few percent of the stars, especially the more massive primaries, the A stars, the B stars, may end up a few percent of the time having a quote-unquote binary companion that ends up being planetary mass.
Sure, I mean, that may well be, and maybe all of the ones that we're looking at are like that.
Well, except maybe 799, because that one...
Yeah, I mean, well, those are fairly, I mean, what are they, like 7 and 10 Jupiter masses? So
they're massive, but they're coplanar, they're very, I mean,
yeah.
That's getting...
Oh, you're right, we may be looking at both cases at once, but I think, I mean, I'm starting to think now, I mean, if you do scatter things to large radius, it's almost hard to keep something like this from happening, would be my take. So even if we don't see any of them now, maybe we will in the future. Probably we will in the future. But yeah, I agree. I mean, there must be a continuum of things going on.
But there's some fine tuning here, right? This is what Brad was saying. If you're able to bring it to on this orbit, just a slightly different collision would get it out of the system, right?
Right, but I mean, remember that there is this dissipative disk there the whole time. So it's not like a straight n-body simulation where you're trying to implant something in the Oort cloud without the background galactic tide, which wouldn't really work. There is a dissipation mechanism all the way down the line.
You have to tune that, right? Otherwise, you'll get the dissipation can stop you at 10 degrees.
Right, right. And I guess this is why this is work in progress. Which,
For the distant planets, is it a robust prediction that there should be a gas giant orbiting at a few AU that could be picked up with radio velocities, for instance?
I would say that that's likely. I think if you do manage to, the further you've scattered something out, the more likely it is that there's a big thing sitting at smaller radius that actually scattered you out. So I would say yes. I mean, if you can't, I don't think you can have a bunch of Neptunes kicking each other around and then end up with something at 100 AU very, very readily.
The general implication seems to be you're kicking things out all the time. So it seems that, I mean, if you're right, there should be lots of these objects that have
That's what I would say, yeah.
Which is not what we're finding yet. I mean, we're obviously only probing only 5 Jupiters and above, typically.
You should stick your neck out. Yeah. Make a prediction.
Yeah. No, if you... Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I'm happy to do that.
No, but you need to make a prediction about the fraction of stars.
Exactly. Yeah.
That would...
Oh, you want an actual number.
Yeah. you can't just say it.
Well, you've already... See, I was going to call these things born again cores, but now you're taking that. Yeah.
No, but the point is that if you do this, that these direct imaging...
These are coming up in about a month.
Are coming up.
Right?
Okay. And also with a gravitational lens and all of that, they can do this detection, mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I think you should stick your neck out.
Okay.
And the prediction we need is something like, saying, is it 90% or is it 10%?
And in fact, okay. I would say that this is a, you know, we're always looking for differences, okay? In our paper one, that Ida and Lin, we actually make observation of this point precisely according to what Brad is saying, that this type of process is very difficult. So we actually have a cutoff in the size distribution in a global sense.
It's
not sort of saying there's not a few exceptions, but there is a general fall off of the at the period fall off.
Yeah.
After about 20, 30, 50 AU.
Yeah. No, I mean this is inevitable.
Is that just the building of the core will scatter a lot of these remaining planetesimal out of there. The the phase space that you have to be able to retain to larger and larger radius to do this is difficult. But those were done for one planet at a time.
Right.
When we did that, okay. And now we're now looking at multiple systems. But I think this is where one can do a real test of theory by making a prediction that is which can be observed within 2 years.
Okay. Well, that's why it's good that I'm here, and I can lock myself in my office and or talk to people that would be better and do that.
So I suppose many of these scattered core are not able to go any down into the disk and therefore may not be able to grow. So your prediction would be there will be many eccentric failed core scattered around.
Not necessarily eccentric. I mean, even if they completely miss out on the gas.
That's the time scale, how you, you know, right. You have repeated crossing of this disk.
Yeah.
The time scale.
Oh, you're talking about inclined.
Inclined, inclined, yes.
Right, okay.
That's the majority, that's the most common case, I imagine. So I would say you predict there should be many of such failed core.
Could well be. I'm not sure that they would be eccentric, because in addition to the gas, that there's also the planetesimals out there, which would go some ways, especially, I mean, if it's a few Earth mass, 10 Earth mass thing, there's enough planetesimal mass out there to drop your eccentricity back down significantly. So even without gas, you could still circularize them.
Just make the growth slow.
Yeah,
slow. They fail.
But that might actually be a positive, right? Because the problem I see with this, with application to 8799 is, if you build 3 7 to 10 Jupiter mass guys more or less at random, their mutual interactions are going to cause havoc. Right?
Yeah.
So the only way to keep these things stable, as we've shown, is to have them settle into some sort of resonant configuration. So you
right.
may need to grow all three somehow yeah. more or less simultaneously in order to just make sure that
yeah.
they all talk to each other. And
my prediction would be exactly that. I mean, if one does this, For Fomalhaut, if you believe Fomalhaut, it seems to work best if you do this very late in the game, very tenuous disk. Almost certainly for HR 8799, it works much better probably if you do it in a more massive disk where you need, like, what, 27 Jupiter masses of gas, for one thing, and as you say, exactly, you need to keep them from going nuts while they're growing, so I would definitely agree with that.
Back to Suzanne's point about the shape of the disk, would you like there to be a lot of mass out at 100 AU? And
some mass. Certainly, I haven't at all tested the dependence of this on the density profile. But certainly, if you make it steeper than that, if you put less mass out there, at some point, this isn't going to work at all. But if you, I mean, this is an R to the minus one. Relatively uncontroversial, like, or relatively middle of the road sort of surface density profile. So you can, I'm sure you can change this, the slope either way a little bit and not make a big difference to this.
Well, I don't know if this, I mean, you have a no cut of 2 or 300 AU.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's not controversial.
Yeah, that's
sorry, say that
again?
I mean, if you were to ask someone who models this, you know, what's the size of a teacher or this, they would not necessarily extend them very easily to beyond the 2 or 300 AU. Even if you consider all the momentum that went in, that's what 1,000 AU is
yeah.
very large.
I have tried a version of this where I cut it off at 500 AU. I mean, Fargo will let you happily have a planet that goes outside of the grid and just comes back. And it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. I mean, it relatively rapidly does, even if a lot of its apo, a lot of the apo part of its orbit is poking out of the outside of the disk, it still does this relatively rapidly, at which point it's then completely inside the disk again. So, you know,
in this scenario, you have an exponential
cutoff.
Yeah. But I think 8799, both had an exterior and exits.
Yeah.
Do you know how many protostellar disks extend out with surface density of this kind or gravitational instability out to 100 to several hundred AU?
No, I don't think I know of
any. You know, even if you look at Orion region, that there is these.
Well, some people claim, I think there are several hundred AUs in some cases have been measured. But they might be.
But there are pseudo disks.
Yeah.
They're in falling. They're not necessarily disks.
Okay. This is the
sort of for example.
At some level, you can imagine this happening during the pseudo disk stage before.
Yeah, but pseudo disks don't last.
Exactly.
So that what you're saying is that you should
there's this natural cutoff due to photoevaporation, which is much closer.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You can avoid it. But if you have, say, several hundred AU, even at the distance of the torus, that's more than two or three arc seconds. Mm-hmm. Okay, two arc seconds,
yeah.
And it should be easy as pie to see it.
What's the scale of the proteids in Orion?
It might.
Orion is bigger. Orion, it's 500 parsec away. And they're about one or two, there's about one arc second. So it could be very big. But it's mostly dusty material, and you have no idea whether that is actually in the process of, it's either pseudo disk or evaporation. In those systems, that's not clear because you see there's some sort of a outflow there.
It might depend on your environment. On torus-like things, you have bigger disks. They are kind of, people claim 400-500 AU, and in ONC you have kind of, up to 100 kind of is the kind of.
Well, definitely one of the simulations.
What people measure.
But what is the surface density there? I mean, that's the point.
Well, in any case, one of the things I'm going to run next, I think, is going to be a smaller disk. See how well that works.
Well, no matter how you form these things, you'd like a huge disk. So this is a general criticism for the existence of these planets.
what's a reasonable disk size?
But if you form like binary companions, then that's not that. That is, doesn't exist. The binary stars up to 10,000.
Well, I mean, Crater has a disk. That's what it says. Crater, for instance, has a disk going out that far. That's how the binary is formed, by a disk.
But
in her scenario.
I know, but not in...
Well, I'll try the most extreme thing for FOMOD, which is to cut the disk off at 100 AU.
I thought you had an example.
Maybe that'll work. We'll see if that works or it doesn't. Cut it off right at where the planet is. And see if, first of all, we can recircularize it and, does it even grow? I'll let you know.
Well, from the host, it's form one.
I don't know. Does anyone know? Is that an upper limit or is that an actual measure?
It's based on the circularity to some extent. It's based on the nature of the
ring.
Okay. Well, if you imagine either a lower mass disk or perhaps a truncated disk, I mean, that might be exactly what you get out of that, that you can go all the way to the end of the disk lifetime and still be left with a bit of eccentricity.
Well, given you're the expert in this process of driving Uranus and Neptune out, do you really need to go to the same mechanisms for the big guys that you do for Fomalhaut? Because Fomalhaut, it has been claimed it could be as low as a Saturn mass. Could you drive Saturn out by the same planetesimal scattering you do Uranus and Neptune if you had a reasonable Jupiter?
There are two different mechanisms here. There's the actual scattering and then recircularization. There's the other stuff that Gomez and company have.
The Thomas of the 1999 stuff, the ping-ponging.
Oh, the ping-ponging. if it was a Saturn mass, I guess you could fully form it and throw it out there.
Right, so the fallout of that, I think you necessarily...
But again, the smaller it is in comparison to the scatterer, of course, the energy. Typically is. But if it really is a Saturn mass or less, then you start coming into the regime where you don't need to do that. And maybe you only have to worry about something like this for HR-8799. That's certainly true.
Something that might be key is just how much migration occurs during the accretion process itself. So you scatter it out and then,
yes,
in that movie there, your planet went from, your protoplanet went from 500 to 100, I think. I don't know if it was linear or some type of, and I'm not sure exactly what prescription you use, but there might be some way, I mean, it's moving to the left in that.
Well, I mean, it depends on what is the mass of the thing when you put it out there. We put it at a mass where it's still below runaway gas accretion, but close for the particular assumed opacity and so on and so forth. So it kind of spends a little bit of time in that sort of classic Pollock et al. Plateau But, I mean, there was a bit of fine-tuning there, of course, you know, because we don't want to wait for 2 million years in a hydro simulation. But in principle, I mean, you could put it out there, and it could be somewhat lower mass, and you could have it sitting out there as long as it gets circularized enough that it gets away from whatever scattered it. It could sit out there for a long time, growing slowly, you know, slowly losing eccentricity, and then as long as, at some point before the gas goes away, as long as it becomes a gas giant, then you're good.
All right.
Okay, I should
be here.
Yeah, we should stop, I think.
Thank you.
This discussion is